From the right, I'm Matt Lewis.
From the left, I'm Bill Scheer.
And you're watching
The Week in Blog.
This week, Bill, politics in the blogosphere has been dominated by conversation about the proposed mosque near Ground Zero. But before we get into that, the end of last week, there was this interesting convergence of controversial blogs and tweets from the right and the left. On the right, you had John Hawkins with his list that conservative bloggers helped compile of the worst figures in American history. And then you had a very controversial tweet from Matthew Iglesias from Think Progress, essentially saying that deception is good and, in fact, sometimes necessary. It's an old story now, but I think still worth examining. What was your take on either or both?
I'm sympathetic to both figures at play here. I know you had a piece up on your site on Politics Daily saying this is both evidence that politics is broken, that on the conservative side, the list that the survey that John Hawkins had put out to get the conservative take on the worst figures in history, and it it had you know Jimmy Carter ahead of Charles Manson, and
Charles Manson didn't even make the list.
Oh, didn't make the list, right?
right.
There were some criminals that were on there, so you couldn't quite say that people weren't thinking about it in those terms.
Right, and if you read the teaser, let me see if I can pull it up. But if you read the teaser that John Hawkins, by the way, of course, John Hawkins, I like John Hawkins, and I think there's some points worth making that I'm going to try to make today that haven't been made yet. But if you actually read the teaser that he put up, and I'm trying to pull it up now, but essentially it said, of all the villains, murderers, crooked politicians, assassins, yada, 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 which are the worst? And, then he goes on to say, that's the question we asked, and these are the 25 worst figures in American history. So, it's not coming up, but I don't want to misquote him, but I'm paraphrasing there. But that's essentially what it was. In his teaser, he acknowledged, crooked politicians would be part of it, but also, villains. I think he said murderers. So, in any event, yeah, you can't say that it was just going to be about politicians.
Right. Having said that, I'd imagine, obviously, you're soliciting a lot of, people whose day-to-day blogging is around politics.
Right.
So it wouldn't shock me that people just, for giggles, would be more inclined to name politicians, or they'd be inclined to name mass murderers. And if you actually sat them down and said, do you really believe that Jimmy Carter was worse than Charles Manson? Some might say, okay, I don't actually believe that.
Right. Well, but Bill, I think part of the issue is just that. I don't think this was like a malicious thing. I don't think people sat down and said Jimmy Carter is worse than Charles Manson. But I think the fact that if you ask conservative bloggers, who do you think is the worst figure, Jimmy Carter comes to mind. And I think that actually is quite telling. It's not malicious, but it shows that, how maybe political centric people are, that they focus on politics. That in itself is a problem, because you step back and you realize there are a lot worse people in the world than Jimmy Carter. But I gotta say, here's something that really didn't get brought up that much. It's a fair point to make. Part of the problem that I think Hawkins had was the methodology of the survey. Basically, as I understand it, so what happens is he asks, 43 conservative bloggers to make the list, and then whoever appears on most lists gets ranked number one. The inherent problem there is, let's assume it was a list of just two people.
There's no weighting here, essentially.
Exactly. So for illustrative purposes here, if you and I did a list and I said the worst person is Charles Manson, and I also included Jimmy Carter on my list, and you said, well, the worst person is Jeffrey Dahmer, and then you also included Jimmy Carter on your list, because you and I both included Jimmy Carter, and I know you hate him as much as anybody.
How dare you force a kid to a peace accords and calmly negotiate the Iran hostage crisis without starting a regional war? It was horrendous, horrendous.
So the fact that you and I had both included Jimmy Carter is what matters more than the fact that you believe Dahmer is the worst and that I believe Manson is the
right.
worst or whatever.
And
you get my point.
I imagine in conservative circles there are certain people that are generally treated as boogeymen, political figures that are sort of your standard, you know, hit list. And the figures you might say are the non-political awful people, the mass murderers and such, there isn't the same, you know, shared consensus who those people are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair to say. I think part of it is obsession with politics over culture, and I also think it's you know, he should have probably not published it. I mean, he could have looked at that list and said...
Well, he's been doing these sorts of surveys... For years, that's sort of been one of at Right Wing News' sort of stock and trade. People love to talk about lists. They love to
forward
lists around. They love to argue about lists. It's a pretty slick, traffic getting tactic.
It's very smart. In fact, he had one out today, the greatest figures in American history, something like that, and it was a pretty good.
Now,
list,
if Jeffrey Dahmer was on that, then it would have something to say about conservatives.
No, actually, you know, those Twitter lists I put together, the top 25 conservatives on Twitter, the top. However many journalists or liberals on Twitter. I got that idea from Hawkins because, you know, he was on my podcast and he said, Matt, I only do lists now because they're the best columns. I get more, you know, I could write, you know, a really in-depthful column and nobody reads it, but if I write a list, everybody reads it. So, yeah, I mean, he's known for that, and I think sometimes, you know, one gets away from you. I think this was... a clear mistake. But the other thing, too, it's funny how blog stories take off. I mean, I wrote a post at Politics Daily kind of observing this story there was some editorial comment in there, but really, you know, I actually linked to a Jim Garrity post where he wrote, "No Charles Manson, come on. You're really telling me that Al Sharpton and Michael Moore outranked somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, who ate people? Race baiting and rabble rousing outrank cannibalism."
And so, we all know that Al Sharpton eats people.
Yes. So my point is, it's funny because this story, and in some ways I became a part of this story, even though I was really writing the post that said, Jim Garrity said.
Jim Garrity at the National Review. He's at the corner, I assume, correct?
Yeah, and of course I editorialized about it as well, but it's just funny how this happens sometimes. Sometimes being first... It means that you get the story, and sometimes it just happens another way. But I was happy to take the credit. You know what I did that no one else did was I combined – it occurred to me because the John Hawkins Right Wing News story came out the exact same day as the Matthew Iglesias Twitter story where he – you know, Matthew Iglesias, of course, formerly of The Atlantic, now with the Center for American Progress, blogging at Think Progress – He got into this tweet conversation with, I think it was Mark Hemingway from The Examiner, and he says, "Fighting dishonesty with dishonesty is sometimes the right thing for advocates to do." Yes.
And wait, so, now, what was the background of this? How did this conversation get instigated?
Oh, geez. I think it was actually in response to something that that Iglesias had written in a blog post, I believe. Then Hemingway and Iglesias went back and forth. Then Josh Trevino, who is another blogger, a co-founder of Red State, got involved. The Daily Caller actually wrote a pretty good piece on it, which was hilarious because at the end of the Daily Caller piece, it says, "In concluding his interview with the Daily Caller, Iglesias said, 'Go F yourself,' and hung up the phone." Of course, he didn't actually say F. He said the F word. "Go F yourself," and hung up the phone. That's a great way to end an interview. I have to give Matt Iglesias credit on this one. You may not agree with with encouraging deception, but telling someone to go F themselves and hanging up, I'd like to end every interview that way.
So the Caller piece had said this came about in a debate about a high-speed rail.
Yeah, and, I think that, isn't that funny how high-speed rail leads to this, right?
And I wrote, this is a digression, but I wrote a post about high-speed rail because one of the gubernatorial candidates in Wisconsin is betting his race on stopping high-speed rail, rejecting federal funds. The federal government saying, here you go, Wisconsin, have some money for high-speed rail. And he wants to turn it down and treat the whole thing as a boondoggle. And so he started a whole website, notrain.com. And there are a couple other candidates out there, John Kasich in Ohio and Meg Whitman in California, who are similarly criticizing high-speed rail, not quite as dramatically as Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And there are other states where that are getting money that the conservative candidates are not making as big a deal about. So I don't know if it's a real trend or not. But it does seem to engender a certain ire, at least in corners of the right.
Yeah, high-speed rail pisses people off. And this might be a good time to recommend the column I wrote a while back called, I think it was called The Conservative Case for Mass Transit or something like that. But there is a conservative argument to be made for investing in light rail. And there are a lot of conservative arguments, but one conservative argument is the free market did not create our current transportation system. It was heavily subsidized. The highways were heavily subsidized by the government. Meanwhile, rails, which actually were privately owned, were actually forbidden, as I recall, from raising their rates, the cost to ride them. So it was really a rigged system from the beginning. But check out that column. It's a little bit old.
You could not unravel the entire transportation system overnight and make it all private. It's impossible.
You know, it's just one of those things. But for whatever reason, light rail gets people going, and apparently it spawned this Matt Iglesias Twitter argument.
So Iglesias wrote a while back that advocates for high-speed rail may need to present, quote, unrealistically optimistic ridership estimates to obtain funding for projects. For better or for worse, that's politics, and that sparked the back and forth.
And this is actually not the first time that he's made a statement like that. In the past, I forget whether it was gay marriage or he was essentially advising liberals to not be honest about their positions when those were politically unpopular positions, be it gay marriage or whatever. So there is a track record of this. I guess the reason that my story caught on was I actually saw these two stories, which nobody else connected, but they both broke last Friday on the exact same day, and we have two prominent bloggers, one on the right, one on the left. Essentially, here's how I thought the stories came together. Because if you believe that your political opponents are worse than mass murderers, if you believe that your political adversaries are actually enemies, okay, I believe that you're politically misguided, Bill, but I think you're a good person. You probably
thank you, Matt.
You probably think the
I
same
think you
thing
eat maybes,
right?
But I think you're also a good person.
So we actually respect each other. We just think that we're each misguided. But that's not the case with a lot. I mean, I think, unfortunately, and here's where when I talked about the system being broken, if you believe that your political adversaries are enemies worse than killers, then the next thing would be you have to stop them. However, whatever it takes to stop them, if that means lying, as Matthew Iglesias recommends, or cheating, or whatever, then you must. It's imperative that you do it because that's how bad they are. And unfortunately, I think that is part of the political culture today. It's a long way from the old days when Reagan said, "The speaker says after 6 o'clock we're all friends."
Well, you know, like I said when we started, I'm charitable towards the John Hawkins thing. I don't really believe that most conservatives actually think Jimmy Carter is worse than Charles Manson. And by the same token, I'm charitable towards what Iglesias was saying. I mean, the oversimplification in the Daily Caller piece, I was to say, Matthew Iglesias advocates lying is not really what he was saying. I think he was trying to give a very coldly honest look at how politics works. and saying, look, this is just the way business gets done. Not to say that he finds it, you know, morally right or wrong. It's maybe more of an amoral, you know, look at it. And not to say I necessarily agree that you have to give unrealistically optimistic estimates for ridership to get high-speed rail passed. I don't think that's necessarily true. But it's not the same as Matthew Iglesias, you know, lies repeatedly on his site. If he was, like, an active liar, he wouldn't say as much as far as his analysis about how politics works.
And that was actually part of the column. I mean, I think he's arguing that political advocates should do it
right
when it's politically expedient, that the end justifies the means. But the problem there, too, is, I mean, number one, I think a lot of political bloggers are political advocates. I mean, he may view himself as more of a journalist, and I think, as far as I can tell...
Or an analyst. To me, I think he takes a particular... he has a lot of open activism on his blog. I wouldn't say he's simply a detached journalist either. You know, I think he's an analyst with a viewpoint. Anyone that's going to, you know, pile on Iglesias and get on, you know, their moral high horse that any, you know, trace of dishonesty is absolutely forbidden, are these people going to reject the support of any politician who functions in America? Because we all know every politician does not have a 100% track record on honesty. It's just not realistic.
Well, we could debate this, but it's an old story, so we should probably move on to a story which I think neither of us are excited about, but it has dominated politics this week in a major way, and that is the controversy over, which actually has been splitting mainly the left, but the right and the left, over this proposed mosque and Islamic cultural center near Ground Zero.
Which I should note is not really a mosque.
And cultural center. In any event, Bill, what I think that most of the action here has been on the left in terms of the divisive story, mainly because you guys have the power. I mean, when the president and the majority leader disagree, that's more important than, say, a blogger and a talk show host disagreeing. So,
well, I don't even know if the president and the majority leader do disagree, quite frankly. I think they have a certain disagreement in that Reid actively said, I think they should not be in that location. And Obama is not talking about where he thinks the right location is. He is staying neutral on that point and emphasizing the First Amendment right for freedom of worship and to be able to have houses of worship, you know, commensurate with local, you know, zoning.
And it's a fair point, but very fair point, and I think that you've described it accurately, but not to pull an Iglesias here, but I feel like the perception is, and probably aided by some, but the perception is that there is a schism here, that Democrats are not united. Because also
from the liberal blogger standpoint, you know, a lot of them are mad at Obama and Harry Reid and now Howard Dean to boot. Because you know, even though there's variances in what they're saying, and they're all saying that they believe that the Park 51 developers have First Amendment rights, they're angry at the whole lot of them for just being for the project, period.
Let me just throw out a couple, because the first shoe to drop this week in terms of the division, of course, President Obama made this, I believe, a national story during a Ramadan celebration at the White House by referencing it. And then he sort of, I don't want to say walked it back, but came up with a clarification the next day. Well, then Harry Reid, came out with his statement. You had people like Peter Dow tweeting, hand it to Dems for being given an issue with unequivocal moral and constitutional high ground and fumbling it. Greg Sargent at the Washington Post wrote, the second most powerful Democrat in the country is not willing to support the president in his efforts to defend the right of Muslims to build a cultural center on private property. If the site in question were in the vicinity of Ground Zero, this comes after his opponent, Sharon Angle, attacked him on the issue this morning.
And I don't think what Sargent said there is accurate. I mean, on that point is where Reid and Obama do agree. They both agree they have the right to do it. It's Reid only making the point that he personally believes that it shouldn't be there.
This did cause Reid some mocking of Reid. Conservative Jim Garrity tweeted, "Send Harry Reid money, Dems. He needs your help so we can continue to adopt Sharon Angle's positions at a slower pace." So that was the Harry Reid.
Now, who said that last one?
That was Jim Garrity from National Review.
I mean, though, as Ben Smith at Politico has noted, the federal government has no role in this. The state government has no role in this. The local government has no role in this beyond, what the Landmarks Commission already voted on. It's not a question of implementing Sharon Angle's views. There is no views of Senators to be implemented in this issue. It's a completely ridiculous issue.
No, but look, there are a lot of stories, a lot of times when people have no say in something, but their opinions of it matter. So, like, Harry Reid obviously doesn't have a vote on whether or not this proposed mosque and cultural center will be built. But he felt compelled to put out a statement saying he opposed it.
He clearly wanted no daylight or as little daylight as possible between him and Sharon Angle. He feels pretty good about where he is in the Nevada race. He doesn't want to give her an opening. I think it's a cynical move. I don't agree with what Harry Reid said, but I still think the whole issue is ridiculous. And I think for Garrity to interpret that as somehow he shares Angle's overall views on issues and will implement them more slowly is just an inaccurate interpretation of that political move.
Well, don't you think though? I mean, President Obama made this a national issue. I mean, this was being talked about.
I would disagree with that.
Well, okay, this was being talked about on blogs and on cable TV, to be sure. But once President Obama injected it into the political bloodstream and brought it up, then it became fair game to ask every Democrat, do you agree with President Obama?
I think it accelerated that. I don't know if it made that happen where it would not have happened otherwise. But my understanding is, and this is a little speculative just based on what I've read on other news sites, my understanding is the president was probably primarily motivated by foreign policy considerations, that this had already become not just a national story, but an international story. And the White House and the State Department are deadly serious about repositioning America's posture in the Arab-Muslim world. And that this debate, as it was being played out in the media, was seriously undercutting that, and therefore was not saying that they could duck it. And as the way the anonymous White House spinners were talking to the press, they weren't talking about walkbacks and nuances and wrinkles in the position. They were saying this is a matter of constitutional principle, period. And they were angry at the notion that the president walked it back in any way. And they furthermore said that we know the politics of this are bad domestically, but we have to do this regardless.
If their goal though was to have America look better in the public opinion of international public opinion, don't you think they've actually accomplished the opposite? I mean, this is a week now that this has been going on almost. It'll be a week by the time this episode airs that this has been the story for an entire week. And it probably doesn't make America look good, but I think part of the reason this story is such a story is that President Obama made it a story. Didn't he actually contribute to the divisiveness and the fighting about this and the high profile this story has received? I mean, we had the withdrawal from Iraq Not all forces, but
all combat forces.
That's the word, combat forces. That should be a huge story. It was, but it's still not as big as this mosque controversy.
I think the people who have contributed to the divisiveness of this issue are the bigots and the racists who made this an issue and have repeatedly lied about what the actual structure and center and imam involved is. They're the ones being divisive. And if Obama said nothing, they would continue to be divisive. These stories would continue to happen. in perpetuity. I mean, remember, this vote at the local level already happened. So they already lost, yet they've still managed to keep this to be, you know, a cable catnip story that have reverberations worldwide. So to the extent that Obama cannot single-handedly stop that from happening by his mere utterances, that's unfortunate. But I don't think his utterances made it worse as far as America's posture towards the world. It at least mitigates the damage that has been done.
Well, along those lines, Connor Friedersdorf, writing for the Daily Dish, essentially argued, well, let me find his actual quote here. He basically argues that, you know, issues like cutting government is hard and unpopular. I guess he's quoting Gene Healy. But in other words, that the culture war issues always come up because they're not as complicated. Anybody can understand them and argue about them. That I think what he is implying here is he thinks that conservatives have grasped onto this as sort of an easy win. I don't know that I agree. I mean, look.
Well, and there was an argument in that post, I think he was quoting somebody else, Will Wilkinson, was it? Saying that this was a cynical move on the part of some conservatives to distract from the small government issues because they're so difficult and that they know that Republicans won't actually follow through on them, which
that
is a pretty tough charge.
That is cynical. It doesn't seem that plausible to me. There's been another theory floated, which also doesn't seem plausible to me. And I don't remember where I heard this, but it has been bandied about that Obama elevated this issue to distract from the economy. That doesn't seem plausible either.
That would seem completely idiotic.
Yeah, but I think it would seem idiotic to do this too. I mean, conservatives were already winning on the economy.
That's what's bizarre to me. I mean, it would seem like you could say, where are the jobs all day long?
Exactly.
And ride that through November.
Which is why I don't think that this is a manufactured story, at least not for those reasons. So.
No, it would strike me that there's some lack of adult supervision on the right when you got a good thing going. There's these impulses to be attracted to these culture war type issues, and there's no Karl Rove essentially to say, you know, that's really not the best target right now. But to the extent that, you know, Connor thinks this is somehow unique to the right, I mean, I think the left is just as much inherently attracted to social issues and cultural issues. Much more attention being put on, say, the Prop 8 ruling and Don't Ask, Don't Tell than, say, the climate bill, when the climate bill was actually a live issue that had a chance of passage. Only after it was pulled, they had a burst of blogger commentary about it. There's something about those issues that are easier to get your arms around and get people's emotions working than there are some of these nuts and bolts policy issues.
Exactly. And I think even among this Park 51 issue debate, there are plenty of liberals and possibly even the president who wants to get into this fight because they believe that it's a noble thing to get involved in. And politics be damned, you know, regardless of the impact it might have on them. But, Bill, I think it's incorrect to think that conservatives have ginned this up. I mean, I really think this is an organic issue.
I mean, they've literally ginned this up.
There are people stoking the fire, but I think this is an organic issue that the American people really, especially New Yorkers, but the American people would say, like, why are we building a mosque near Ground Zero?
There's some polling that questions that. You have.
Let's talk about it. You sent that link around. Let's talk about it.
You have Greg Sargent of the Plumb Line talked to the top Gallup pollster, Frank Newport, saying that 34% disapprove of Obama's comments, only 20% who approve. What Frank Newport said suggests it's not clear this is such a disaster after all. The disapproval is overwhelmingly Republican. A larger percentage doesn't even have an opinion. And then you have a separate Time poll that came out today saying, you know, sure, most voters are against Park 51 from happening, but most voters, I think it was I think it was 3/4, forgive me if I'm quoting the number wrong, said this was not a voting issue for them come November, which seems to indicate it's not really a high-priority issue.
I still think it's going to be the economy, no matter
what. Right, right, exactly. I mean, that is the issue. I mean, you have Pam Geller at Atlas Shrugged, who has been a leading conservative blogger, banging the drum on this. Ben Smith of Politico said there was another more behind-the-scenes figure. I forget the person's name. I think it was connected to Ron Lauder, who was a conservative figure in New York City. That's been pushing a lot of media about this. You know, there's definitely an organized effort to make this a media issue. And maybe that sparked a wildfire. Now a good chunk of the country does care. But this is very much driven by a corner of the conservative movement.
Well, I think we'll probably have to disagree slightly, but I think it's a nuanced disagreement.
Now, the other big division on the left on this that came out in the past 24 hours was Howard Dean making, I think, even more critical comments about the center than Harry Reid did. I mean, Reid just sort of had this for a very, you know,
yeah,
two-sentence statement.
Well, the other
statement.
Thing, too, is, I mean, let's not forget, part of it is that, but, I mean, Howard Dean, you know, was thought of in 2004 as being from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. I mean,
right,
Harry Reid, for crying out loud, wanted, you know, to get rid of the 14th Amendment in like 1993.
He wanted apologize for that.
Yes. But Howard Dean has been, in recent years at least, I know at one point he was like NRA endorsed, I think, as governor of Vermont. But since 2004, he has been positioned as a liberal's liberal, like a Feingold. So
absolutely, and I think particularly in the blogosphere, because so many bloggers got into blogging or got into online politics because of the Howard Dean presidential campaign and stayed in it because of the Democracy for America group that he founded. You know, one blogger said, you know, my heart breaks at him. He made comments on a conservative talk show in New York, not just that the center shouldn't be there, but that it was an affront to the people who had died, which I think it was Josh Marshall. That just doesn't make any sense. We're not even talking about the family, some of the actual people who had died. It said an affront to Muslims who had died, which makes even less sense. So there were, you know, good reasonable compromise being worked out without violating the principle that people ought to be able to worship as they see fit. And some people were scratching their heads in the left. How could he say this? Where is the right, you know, editing his piece in some way? And
Breitbart's name
the case.
Was mentioned. Glenn Greenwald, I think, asked, you know, wondered if this was a Andrew Breitbart editing job.
Right, but he checked it to himself and said, "I've looked at the full transcript. I've seen I've heard the audio. It's all for real." He said it. Although Greenwald did post today, maybe this will happen by the time before our segment gets published, that Greenwald's going to do a video interview with Dean and explore this further. Dean, as you noted, you know, was not always considered such a liberal.
Right.
Liberals in Vermont were not happy with him when he was governor of Vermont.
And by the way, I'm told that not only was Howard Dean at one point considered fairly conservative, but Joe Trippi, his campaign manager, who, you know, during that time in 04, you would know this better than me, Bill, but I understand that he wasn't always considered to be so liberal either.
I can't speak to Trippi's, you know, personal politics as much. I mean, certainly Trippi, I think, has a sort of long-standing interest in, you know, changing the system. You know, he was a Jerry Brown guy in
love that book,
1992,
man. You've read
that was all about small donor campaigns and all that sort of thing.
The revolution will not be televised.
Right,
everybody
right.
should read that. Great stuff.
So, you know, you can be that way and not be a doctrinaire liberal on every issue. And Dean never has been a doctrinaire liberal on every issue, but that aspect of his political history has certainly been glossed over in recent years. You know, in fact, when he was running in 2004, when he initially had a line in his stump speech that, you know, whites with Confederate flag decals on the back of their truck should be voting with us because their kids need health care and education, too.
Right.
You know, a lot of liberals at the time embraced that line thought it was very innovative. You know, he had applause for that when he first said it in front of a, you know, multiracial audience at a Democratic Party national gathering.
I think they did use that against him.
They eventually did. He repeated it at one point in kind of a more flippant and garbled way, that where the nuance of it wasn't appreciated, and it got rammed down his throat by opposing Democratic candidates, and he stopped using it. But my point there is, I think he's always had in his mind that he is a certain kind of bridge builder, mm-hmm. and he's talking about these Park 51 comments as a way, this isn't building bridges, and the developers should back off because they're not building bridges.
By the way, Ben Domenech, Red State co-founder, he's at the New Ledger now, he tweeted something to the effect of, I thought a couple months ago that Howard Dean was going to run for president. Now I'm sure of it. So
that makes no sense at all.
Well, that's exactly what Dave Weigel tweeted back. But Domenech was making the argument that this is Howard Dean positioning himself to run against Barack Obama.
How would pissing off all of his supporters online?
That's what Dave Weigel tweeted back.
So I get where Dean is coming from here in that respect, because it's in line with some things they said in the past as far as how do I reach out to groups that are not, you know, intrinsically in the liberal progressive camp. You know, he reached out to a lot of anti-abortion activists when he was DNC chair. That's also been glossed over. And I didn't oppose him doing that. I do think his implementation of that philosophy here doesn't wash. And over at Balloon Juice, Mr. Mix said, Dean treats this whole ginned up affair like some kind of grassroots serious protest instead of a lie calculated to inflame. You can't have genuine listening when the whole conversation starts with BS. And that's where I would agree with Mr. Mix there. This is not an example of an opportunity to bridge bed. You're dealing with inherently insincere actors in the first place.
Well, I guess we've pretty much hit it all. That has dominated the week.
We got through this without pissing each other off, I think. unless I have pissed you off and you're being nice to me.
One of the things I like is when I read in the comments, I wade through the haters, and I get into the comments, there's always a couple people saying, you know what I like about the Weekend Blog? You have a conservative and a liberal who disagree on the issues and yet get along, and that's refreshing. So it's always a pleasure doing this with you.
And you as well. I was worried about this week because this whole issue annoys me so much.
You seem affable.
But we always find a way, Matt.
That's right, man. All right, check us out on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter at The Weekend Blog. And we will see you next week on The Weekend Blog. See you, Bill.
Take care.